This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lin-Manuel Miranda, has left his title role in Hamilton, his hip-hop musical about the Founding Fathers. But this Broadway sensation keeps growing. A production of the show is running in Chicago. Another production will be opening in London. The Hamilton mixtape was recently released, featuring covers of songs from the show by artists like Usher, Alicia Keys, and The Roots. The Broadway production won 11 Tonys, and Hamilton won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. Miranda's first Broadway show, In the Heights, was a musical set in a Latino neighborhood in New York, similar to the one he grew up in. In 2008, it won the Tony for Best Musical. Miranda is nominated for a Golden Globe for one of the songs he wrote for the new Disney animated film Moana. Let's start with that song. The story is about the daughter of the chief on a Polynesian island. She yearns to leave the island, have an adventure, and find her true calling. This is the anthem Moana sings before setting out on her own. It's called How Far I'll Go. It's sung by Auli'i Cravalho.
I wish I could be the perfect daughter, but I come back to the water no matter how hard I try. Every turn I take, every trail I track, every path I make, every road leads back to the place I know where I cannot go, where I long to be. See the light where the sky meets the sea, it calls me, and no one knows how far it goes. If the wind in my sail on the sea stays behind, how far I'll go, I know.
Lin-Manuel Miranda, welcome to Fresh Air. So what did you do to get into the mindset of an adolescent girl yearning to leave her safe little island paradise and have an adventure and find her calling?
I just remembered when I was an adolescent girl longing to leave my island and
yeah,
find my calling.
Thing.
I just went right back there.
Absolutely.
You know, that's not a glib answer. I think the fun of writing that song was finding the specificity in the story you're telling. This is not someone who hates where they live and wants to go somewhere else. This is someone who loves where they live, and yet there's still this voice saying they should go somewhere else. And so that's messier. You know, that's more complicated. And to that end, I actually went to my parents' house, holed up at my childhood piano, and wrote in my old bedroom, because I figured, let me get to that feeling of sort of, there's an impossible distance between me and what I want when you're in your childhood bedroom.
So what was the thing you wanted that there was an impossible distance from when you were an adolescent?
A life in this business,
mm-hmm.
You know, a life making stuff. I have two wonderful, supportive, and very practical parents who were like, you're really talented and really creative. You should be a lawyer because there's a safe path there. And I knew I was never going to be a lawyer. And I knew that I wanted to make movies and I wanted to write shows. And the distance between 200th Street and that just felt very wide. So I kind of got back to that place.
Did you go to a lot of Disney animated films when you were growing up? And did the music of those mean anything to you?
Yeah, I had the great joy of being 9 years old when The Little Mermaid came out. And I went and saw that 3 times in the theater. Then I dragged my parents back and my family back to see it a couple more times. I don't know why it changed my life as much as it did. I think Sebastian the Crab had a big amount to do with it. The fact that this Calypso number happens under the water just knocked my socks off when I was a kid. It had like this power over me. I would perform that thing. I would jump up on my desk in fourth grade and sing that song. And then I had the good fortune of being a kid during that really kind of amazing run of musical animated films. It's Little Mermaid, followed by Beauty and the Beast, followed by Aladdin, followed by The Lion King. That's an incredible run. And what's been exciting is there's this incredible Pixar golden age and really golden age from all these other studios as well. And it feels like we're in another one of those where musicals have a seat at the table. You've got Tangled, you've got Frozen, next to Inside Out, next to Zootopia. And so it's exciting to be a part of that tradition again.
Okay, so I want to talk to you about Hamilton. and so let's start with My Shot. And
sure.
So this is...
Which is the, you know, an adolescent who wants to go out and change the world. I mean, it's a Disney princess song.
Okay, that's interesting. This is Alexander Hamilton making his big statement about how, you know, he's come to America, he's going to make it, and he's not giving away his shot. You know, and first it's going to be in the Revolutionary War and then in the new American government. So let's hear some of it, and then we'll talk. So this is Lin-Manuel Miranda from the cast recording of Hamilton.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship to King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is I got a lot of brains, but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough. A shining piece of coal, trying to reach my goal. My power of speech, unimpeachable. Only 19, but my mind is older. These New York City streets get cold. I shoulder every burden, every disadvantage I've learned to manage. I don't have a gun to brandish. I walk these streets famished. The plan is to fan this spark into a flame. But damn, it's getting dark, so let me spell out the name. I am the A-L-E-X-A-N-D-E-R. We are meant to be a colony that runs into.
That's Lin-Manuel Miranda from his cast recording of Hamilton. So you are so incredible at these like intricate rhymes that you do in this show. How do you assemble all these intricately placed rhymes?
For me, the fun of writing my shot was it's Hamilton's declaration of purpose, and I wanted to demonstrate his intellect and his ambition, not just in what he was saying, but in the way he was saying it. So prior to his arrival and singing my shot, the other guys in that bar, right, Lawrence, Mulligan, and Lafayette, are rhyming at the end of the line. It's, I'm John Lawrence in the place to be, two pints of sand, Adams, but I'm working on three. We rhyme at the end of the line. And then here comes Hamilton, and suddenly you're getting a lot of internal assonance and a lot of internal rhyming. And not content to just rhyme at the end of the line, but, you know, have these big pun-esque lyrics, you know, I know the action in the street is exciting, but Jesus, between all the bleeding and fighting, I've been reading and writing. So it's, they're intricately tied together. And if you consider that Hamilton is delivering this in real time, suddenly you're like, whoa, this is the greatest freestyler who ever lived. And so that was the fun in constructing that. And it was many days and months of work to sort of make his lyrics just that much more intricate than everybody else's.
Because he was so smart and so verbal.
Yes.
Yeah. So do you use any tools like a rhyming dictionary? Do you catalog words? Do you have like lists of words that you, like when you were doing your research, did you write down key words that you thought would be good to use in lyrics, and so that you'd have a kind of storage box of like words or phrases that you could work with?
I would love to tell you that that's exactly what I did. That would seem like I took such care. But honestly, I kind of throw the kitchen sink at whatever situation I'm in at the moment I'm writing. So I remember when I got up to Lafayette's section and being like, wow, I don't even have conversational French. So going and figuring, how do you say in French? How do you say, how do you count to 10 in French? I didn't know any of these very elementary things. And doing research just to be able to have it feel tossed off by Lafayette, a mix of French and English, while he is learning English in the original colonies. And that was, you know, that amount of time that I spent for those two lines. And also sort of a love letter to Lancelot in Camelot, which is my mother's favorite score. So have him ending his line with C'est moi, which is Lancelot's big tune. That's my little love letter to Lerner and Lowe, just him saying that. So the answer is no. I stop and research whatever situation that's in. That being said, I did have Ron Chernow's book as a guidepost.
Do you do anything to be able to capture the speed without tripping up your tongue? Does it get harder or easier over time when you're doing the same, you know, raps every night? And again, it's really fast, intricate lyrics, and you have to get them on the beat and do it without stumbling.
The fact that I'm a performer helps me enormously as a lyricist. I wouldn't give a performer something I couldn't deliver myself.
Mm-hmm.
With the occasional exception of David Diggs, who's just so exceptionally articulate and able to articulate at high speeds, that I give him some raps that I probably couldn't deliver the same way at that velocity. But I'm not trying to make something that is difficult to perform every night. It needs to proceed at the speed of that character's thought, because that's the only way it's actable. But you know, it's interesting. I think it was an enormous challenge to do that show every night. And yet, who to blame but myself? I wrote the part. And it was also the most thrilling roller coaster every night. You know, I got to fall in love. I got to win a war. I got to write words that inspired a nation. It's something I'll never get old of, which is why I really tried to downplay my departure as much as possible, because I don't think I'm remotely done with it. I'm too envious when I see Josh Henry as Burr and Karen Olivo as Angelica in Chicago. I want to jump up there with them and go through it again.
You should go back and do Aaron Burr the next time.
You know, I suggested that to Tommy Kail yesterday and he laughed in my face.
He's the director, right?
He's the director.
Why did he laugh at you?
He laughed at me because it's just built very differently. You know, it's I don't think people are going to ask for a Christmas album of Lin Miranda singing. No one's asking for my dulcet tones like they are for you, Terry. You know, no one wants to hear me crooning a ballad. And that's fine. Like, but it is a different skill set than the one I have.
All right. I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. It's so funny. I had this conversation with him last night. I said, seriously, if you were to put me in any other role, and Tommy laughed and said, you're seriously asking me? And I said, yeah, seriously, if I were not to play Hamilton, what could I play? He said, you'd be an okay, you'd be an okay Lafayette Jefferson. So if I were to play any other part, you may see me as Lafayette Jefferson one day, but I don't think I'll ever play Burr.
So Hamilton has such an interesting connection to the White House for two reasons. The show basically originates at the White House. You started off thinking of Hamilton as a concept album about Alexander Hamilton. And the first time you performed one of the songs, the opening song from the show, it was at the White House. What was it, like an evening of American music or something that Michelle Obama
presented? Yeah, it was
an
evening of poetry and spoken word, yeah. And it was in about May of 2009, you know, fresh new administration, and thrilled to be asked. And I had written the verses for what became the opening number of Hamilton, and then sort of adapted it to that room. You know, there was no piano arrangement. I got together with Alex and was like, all right, this is where I think we're headed.
This is Alex Lacamoire, your pianist.
Alex Lacamoire, my music director.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, so we prepared it for that evening. And the people filming that evening's events, it wasn't the typical C-SPAN footage. HBO shot the night because they were following some of their poets who were performing. There was a series on these poets. So the result is this insane, like, cinematic HD footage of this performance that I think got posted later that fall. I think it was posted in like October or November. You can check the YouTube. And then it really kind of went viral among people for whom history and hip hop is interesting.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of that performance at the White House from 2009. Here's Lin-Manuel Miranda.
I'm thrilled the White House called me tonight because I'm actually working on a hip-hop album. It's a concept album about the life of someone I think embodies hip-hop, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. You laugh, but it's true. He was born a penniless orphan in St. Croix of illegitimate birth, became George Washington's right-hand man, became Treasury Secretary, caught beef with every other founding father, and all on the strength of his writing. I think he embodies the word's ability to make a difference. I'm going to be doing the first song from that tonight. I'm accompanied by Tony and Grammy-winning music director Alex Lacamoire. Anything you need to know, I'll be playing Vice President Aaron Burr. And snap along if you like. How
How does a bastard orphan son of a whore and a Scotsman dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by Providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar? The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of a trade and charter. And every day while slaves were being slaughtered or carted away across the waves, our Hamilton kept his guard up. Inside, he was longing for something to be a part of the brother.
That's Lin-Manuel Miranda performing the opening number from Hamilton at the White House with Michelle and Barack Obama in the audience. So let's skip ahead to just a few weeks ago when Vice President-elect Mike Pence attended Hamilton, and he was cheered, he was booed when he was there. And then when the show was over, Brandon Victor Dixon, who now plays Aaron Burr, came out and read like a little speech directed to Mike Pence. And I'll read some of it for our listeners who might not have heard this yet. This is what he said. Mm-hmm. Vice President-elect Pence, we welcome you, and we truly thank you for joining us here at Hamilton in American Musical. We really do. We, sir, are the diverse America who are alarmed and anxious that your new administration will not protect us, our planet, our children, our parents, or defend us and uphold our inalienable rights, sir. But we truly hope this show has inspired you to uphold our American values and to work on behalf of all of us, all of us. Thank you truly for seeing this show, this wonderful American story, told by a diverse group of men, women of different colors, creeds, and orientations. So you co-wrote this. That's my understanding. You co-wrote it with the director and the producer. Do I have that right?
Yes, with Tommy and Jeffrey. We got the heads up that he was coming that afternoon and sort of put that together before his arrival.
Okay, so what was the conversation like between you and whoever else was involved about whether you should say something or not?
Well, the conversation was, this has been an incredibly divisive election with a lot of hurt feelings and disappointment and anger on both sides. And the overwhelming sort of statement within that statement is, we truly hope you lead all of us. We're a play that tells the story of our founders with a very diverse company that we feel, reflects what our country looks like now. And so it was really intended as an olive branch, please lead all of us. And what I was really grateful for was that Sunday, Mike Pence really was grateful for that, and I think got it in the sentiment in which it was intended. He said, I wasn't offended. I assure you that we are trying to lead all of you. And so I was grateful for his statements and for him stopping to listen. He didn't have to do that, but he did. And I thought it felt like a civil dialogue between us.
So you said Vice President-elect Mike Pence took this speech very well. President-elect Trump did not. He tweeted, the theater must always be a safe and special place. The cast of Hamilton was very rude last night to a very good man, Mike Pence. Apologize! ! And he tweeted, our wonderful future Vice President Mike Pence was harassed last night at the theater by the cast of Hamilton, cameras blazing. This should not happen! ! What was your reaction to the tweets?
Well, here's where I agree with the president-elect. The theater should always be a safe space. It's, in fact, I think one of the reasons Hamilton's been embraced by people of every stripe on the political spectrum is that theater is one of the rarest places where we still come together. You may take a totally different conclusion from Hamilton than I do based on your ideology and your politics and your life experience, but we all sat in a room together and we watched the same thing. And that doesn't happen anymore. As you can see from this election, we have our own sets of facts based on who we listen to, which news organization gets our business determines the facts that get in our head. I think one of the things that makes theater special is, first of all, it's one of the last places you put your phone away. And second of all, it's one of the last places where we all have a common experience together. So, you know, to that end, I agree with him. I don't agree with his characterization of what we did. I think anyone who sees that video sees Brandon silencing the boos that were not coming from anyone involved in our company, but from the audience itself, who were 9 days after the election are still working through that thing. I can't speak to that. But I know that Brandon quieted the boos and made a plea to lead all of us. And I don't believe there's anything remotely resembling harassment in what we've done.
So Hamilton is in part a story about an immigrant and about immigrants, and which, of course, relates to your family background. Your father came to New York from Puerto Rico for college, and your mother...
Technically making him not an immigrant because Puerto Rico is a commonwealth, but... The experience of Spanish to English and displacement is very similar.
Exactly. And your mother, I think, moved as an infant to the U.S. from Puerto Rico.
Correct.
And you grew up in a predominantly Latino neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
You went to, like, the Hunter College Elementary and High School. Do I have that right?
That's right.
Yeah. So you've spoken in the past about this divide between who you were at home and in your Latino neighborhood and who you were at school. With friends, what was the difference between those two yous?
Oh, man. I feel like we've just stepped into code switch because that's what I was doing. I think that's sort of the interesting thing. I mean, I think if you want to make a recipe for making a writer, have them feel a little out of place everywhere. Have them be an observer kind of all the time. And that's a great way to make a writer. I won the lotto when I got into Hunter to get a great... free public school education sort of saved my family, and I was aware of it. I was aware of that I was at a school with kids who were really smart, and I also had friends in the neighborhood who went to the local school, and I remember feeling that drift happen. You know, when you spend your entire day with someone, your closer friends become the ones you go to school with, and yet I'd still have sleepovers with the friends from the neighborhood, make movies with my friends from the neighborhood, and you know, the corner of that I lived in was like this little Latin American country. It's one in which the nanny who lived with us and raised us, who also raised my father in Puerto Rico, never needed to learn English. All of the business owners in and around our block all spoke Spanish. And yet I'd go to school and I'd be at my friends' houses on the Upper East Side and Upper West Side, and I'd be the one translating to the nanny who spoke Spanish. So it's interesting to become a Latino cultural ambassador when you're 7. You know what I mean? So I had that experience as well. So, you know, we change depending on the room we're in. I'm talking quieter because I'm talking to Terry Gross.
So you obviously, you know, love rap and hip hop. What were the first recordings that made a big impression? The first rap recordings that made a big impression on you?
I have several. I remember my sister bringing home the Fat Boys when I was really little, and also taking me to the first hip hop movies. I remember going to see Beat Street and going to see Breakin' as a really little kid, being sort of dragged along by my older sister. My sister is as responsible for anyone for giving me good taste in music. I remember stealing her copy of Black Sheep's A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing and learning engine number 9 on the New York Transit Line. I think that's probably the first rap song I really worked hard to memorize in sixth grade. But then also, you know, Naughty by Nature and Queen Latifah. The music you love when you're a teenager is always going to be the most important to you. And I find that it's all over the score of Hamilton. The quotes are Biggie quotes. They're a big pun. I mean, these are all New York East Coast 90s rappers. And that's when I was a teenager.
So I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to do one of the first rhymes that you remember writing, that you still remember today.
Well, hello, my name is Lynn, but if you're dyslexic, call me Nil. My rhymes are gonna kill, so I suggest you write your will and leave your to me. I am the epitome. Your coolness can't be writ to me because I will be hitting the mic tonight. Notice my voice went up about 2 octaves. It's because at that time I was listening to nothing but The Far Side, and my favorite rapper in The Far Side had that, "Well, there she goes again, the dopest Ethiopian, and now the world around me." It was that cadence, and I think my rapper voice is still influenced by Far Side. But that is those lines were a rhyme I wrote in ninth grade that I showed to friends, and they were like, "All right, stick to your day job."
Oh, come on, that was pretty good. That was funny.
Yeah.
So, okay, and I'm going to put you on the spot one more time. Your father has or had a political consulting company. He worked with New York City Mayor Ed Koch. He still has it, and advising him on Latino affairs. And you apparently wrote jingles when you were younger for this political consulting company that your father owns. Mm-hmm. So how old were you when you started writing them? And please sing one for us.
Well, jingles is misleading because it sounds like, how I wait to wake up in the morning. It's not, they're not like I Like Ike. It's background music for commercials. So there's nothing catchy I can sing you. But yeah, I started writing those really out of college. I was paying the rent like every other struggling writer. And I was teaching part-time 7th grade English at my old school at Hunter. And then after a year of teaching regularly, I went into just subbing, being a professional sub to have more time to write. And then my dad would... I was basically cheap labor for my dad. He would say, "I need 30 seconds of some jazz for a Sharpton spot that's going to be on WBLS. Or I need some bright salsa for a Fernando Ferrer campaign commercial." You know, I wrote music for Elliot Spitzer before we knew what we knew when he was running for governor. I wrote for Carl McCall. And whatever Democrat was running or my dad was working with, I was writing the campaign music. I liked writing the negative ads more than because it's more minor chords. You just kind of hit the synthesizer. "Politician X voted against, da, da, da." And then it ends with bright salsa. "Dun, da, dun, 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 vote politician Y."
Oh, that's great. So, you know how you were talking about the compartmentalized you were when you were at home and in your Latino neighborhood, and the you were at school when your friends mm-hmm. were white and not Latino, and then you learned finally to bring all those parts together. Was the same kind of compartmentalization happening for you musically? You loved Broadway shows, and you loved hip-hop, and it's maybe hard to find people who, when they're teens, love both.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And honestly, what a fantastic question, because theater is really the thing that began to break that divide for me. My senior year in high school, I was the director of the school musical, and I picked West Side Story, painfully aware that there were not enough Latino kids to play all the sharks in West Side Story at Hunter, or at least audition. And so what that became for me was actually this kind of weird way of bringing my culture to school. I remember being knocked out when I first saw the movie in sixth grade that there's actually a musical number in the canon about whether you should stay in Puerto Rico and live in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's amazing when you're 12 and you grow up in New York and your family's all from this other island, to have that conversation happening in front of you in an iconic musical. I had my white and Asian sharks, and I brought my dad in, and he did dialect coaching. You know, while they're singing America, I want the things they're yelling while they're cheering each other on to be accurate. I want the accents to be accurate. So it actually, it became a way to bring home to school, directing that production. Also, you know, I think I started writing musicals because I saw Rent on my 17th birthday, and I can't overstate how much that gave me permission to write musicals. You know, I loved musicals. I loved being in the school play and being lucky enough to get parts in the school play. But they always took place in some other time and place. You know, it's Phantom is in Paris and Les Mis is in, you know, they're all, a lot of them in France, a lot of the ones I grew up with in the 80s. But they always took place in some mythical time, some mythical place. And here is this musical, again, by a talented young man who didn't live to see it open on Broadway. And it's about artists living in the village right now. And I think I started writing because no one had ever told me, you can write about the things you know in a musical. They don't have to come from some far off place.
Did you ever have friends who loved hip-hop who thought that there was something wrong with you because you also liked Broadway?
No. And then here's the other thing that I feel really lucky about. I grew up in the time just when cassettes were waning and CDs were growing. And so mixtapes, and not mix CDs, mixtapes were an important part of the friendship and mating rituals of New York adolescence. If you were a girl and I wanted you to show you I like you, I would make you a 90-minute cassette wherein I would show off my tastes. I would play a musical theater song next to a hip-hop song, next to an oldie, next to some pop song you maybe never heard. Also subliminally telling you how much I like you with all these songs. I think I learned more about writing scores for Broadway by making mixtapes in the 90s than I did in college. You're learning about rise and fall and energy and tempo shifts. You're showing off your taste and your references. You're trying to be witty through placement of music you didn't write. And so it's no accident that the initial name for my show was the Hamilton Mixtape. That's how I approached writing the score.
Oh, that's why you called it that. Oh, okay. I get it.
Yeah, it's here's everything I know about this guy, and it's a ride, and you're along for the ride. And again, the reason I make the distinction cassette before CD is you have to listen to it in the order in which I've curated it for you. You know, side A to side B is our act break. And I say all that to answer your question because I had friends who only listened to hip hop. I had friends who only listened to musicals. And I stood proudly in the middle. And I'd say, I'm going to change your life with this song.
So I have to ask you about Stephen Sondheim because you have a very interesting history with him. First of all, when you were directing West Side Story in high school, he came to your class because he was the friend of the father of one of the students in the cast and spoke to you.
John Wideman's daughter, who's very good friends with, who's still like one of my wife's best friends. They were in the same grade.
He wrote the book for Assassins and Pacific Overtures?
Pacific Overtures,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so there's that. So you get to meet him in high school. And then you get to write the Spanish lyrics for the Spanish production of West Side Story. And
right.
Then you got to be in a production of Merrily We Roll Along, which was a great Sondheim musical that always needs to be revived because the original Broadway run was so very short. And so this was a New York City Center Encores production.
Correct.
And in fact, I want to play just a little bit of you in that, which Encores was gracious enough to say. I saw you in this production.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it was great. So you're playing a lyricist who works with a composer, but the composer has kind of like sold out. And, you know, he's just doing like commercial work. And the lyricist now has come to think of the composer instead of just being his friend and collaborator, Franklin Shepard. He thinks of him now as like Franklin Shepard, Inc., because he's so much about like deals and making money. So in this scene, like you're getting interviewed on TV and you're just kind of pretty bitter about the whole collaboration with this composer. So here's my guest, here's my guest, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Now, how do you two work together?
I answer that?
Please.
How do we work together? Sure. He goes. And I go. And soon we're humming along. And that's called writing a song. Then he goes. And I go. And the phone goes ring. And he goes mutter, 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 mutter. Yes, Jerome. Mutter, no, Jerome. Mutter, 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 mutter. That's his lawyer, Jerome. Mutter, 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 mutter. Do it, Jerome. Click sorry, Charlie. So I go. And he goes, and I go, and soon we're tapping away. Sorry, Charlie, it's the secretary, on the intercom. Yes, Miss, it's a messenger. Thanks, Miss, will you tell him to wait? Will you order the car? Will you call at the bank? Will you wire the coast? Will you ring? Sorry, Charlie, mutter, 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 sell the stock, mutter, buy the rights, mutter, 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 let me put you on hold. Yes, Miss, it's the interview. Thanks, Miss, will you tell him to wait? Will you wire the car? Will you order the coast? Will you send up the bank?
And the telephones blink and the stocks get sold, and the rest of us he keeps on hold. And he's into making movies, and he's now a corporation, right? So I play at home with my wife and kids, and I wait to hear the movie bids. And I've got a little sailboat, and I'm into meditation, right? He flies off to California. I discuss him with my shrink. That's the story of the way we work, me and Franklin Shepherd Inc. I'm surprised at how much I like this.
Okay, that's my guest, Lin-Manuel Miranda, a production of the New York City Center Encore's Great American Musical Series and a production of Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along. You're so much fun in that, and I really think doing hip-hop rhymes is great preparation for that lyric.
Absolutely.
For singing that, yeah. And Sondheim has written so many, he's just like the most brilliant lyricist, but what are some of the things you feel you learned either from talking with Sondheim? Because I know he also gave you feedback on Hamilton before you actually put it on stage. So what are things you've learned from actually talking to him or just from like getting intimately acquainted with his work?
A couple of things. First of all, I am one of so many composers he's taken the time to encourage, and I feel very grateful to be one of many. I'm by no means unique in that I've gotten words of encouragement from Steve Sondheim. Many in my generation have, and that's been incredible. The way in which he specifically helped me with Hamilton, first of all, by saying that's a great idea when I first told it to him. The first time I met him to work on those translations, he said, "What else are you working on? What comes after In the Heights?" And I said, "I think musical about Alexander Hamilton." And he threw up his head and said, "That is a fantastic idea." And that moment kept me nourished for months, you know, when the writing was tough, when I couldn't figure out how to end those first four lines of my shot. The notion that Sondheim threw up his head and said, "That's a fantastic idea," you know, kept me sane. But the thing he always sort of stressed was variety, 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 variety. When you're dealing with a constant rhythm, no matter how great your lyrics are, if you don't switch it up, people's heads are going to start bobbing and they're going to stop listening to what you're saying. So consistently keep the ear fresh and keep the audience surprised. And, you know, that was his sort of watchword throughout the writing of Hamilton. I'd send him a batch of songs and he'd say, "I'm going to say it again, variety, variety, variety." And so I, you know, that was my mantra during the writing of that show.
The Sondheim song that's closest to comic rap is, in my opinion, Not Getting Married, which is
thank
done.
Thank you, as everybody here, because if everybody's here, I'd like to thank you all for coming to the wedding.
Yeah, do more.
I'd appreciate your going even more. I mean, you must have lots of better things to do, and not a word of it's Paul. Remember, Paul, you know the man I'm going to marry, but I'm not, because I'd never ruin anyone as wonderful as he is. Thank you all for the gifts and the flowers. Thanks you all for the card and the showers. Don't tell Paul, but I'm not getting married today.
Anyone who could do that song has an incredible tongue.
Absolutely.
It's so tricky. It's so fast. And the words are so just kind of like dense and funny and rhymey. And so obviously, you know that song by heart, more or less. And have you thought about that song a lot in terms of intricate rhyme schemes and what the human voice is capable of without totally tripping up?
Honestly, I think about that song more when people ask me, "How did you think rap was going to work on Broadway?" And I go, "Nothing in my show is faster than Getting Married Today in Company." Yeah. So I don't know what you're talking about. There's so much precedent for the work in both quote-unquote hip-hop and not in terms of patter for the stage. But, you know, what's amazing about Getting Married Today is it's also in a masterclass in making a lyric easy. There are consonants on which you waste air. H. There's no H's in that. Because if you say huh, you've lost half the air in your lungs. So it's very T's and P's. Thank you all. Is everybody here? Because if everybody's here, I'd like to thank you all for coming to the wedding. It's more about breath control than it's not a tongue twister. It's very consciously not a tongue twister. It's about being able to say it in one continuous breath and getting out of the way and choosing words that do not require any extra air or any extra tongue or jaw work. So it's actually not about trying to making it hard. It's about making it easy.
So did you learn that intuitively, or did Sondheim tell you that that was his intention, to stay away from as many H's as possible and to keep it to things that could easily be said?
I think I read about that in a conversation he had at some point. But I also knew that intuitively because of the hip-hop artists I liked who rapped fast. You know, they're not trying to make something that's hard for them to perform every night. They're trying to make something that sounds impressive and is a joy to deliver every night. I'm trying to think of like a really specific early 90s example. Queen Latifah, snatch a stature, your broke head looks more like a fracture. Catch that rap, but Latifah will be back to crush ya. That's Queen Latifah in 1992, and it's fast. There's Queen Latifah's UNITY. She goes, there's plenty of people out there with triggers ready to pull it. Why are you trying to jump in front of the bullet, young lady? No H's. So you learn intuitively that like the writer is trying to make something that flows easily off the tongue.
So did the writer of Alexander Hamilton try to avoid H's in writing
well,
the lyrics?
Well, you will observe that Hamilton is not in any of the fast rapping that happens on stage, right? It's George Washington goes, Hamilton, and then Jefferson is the one who goes, sir, he knows the do in a trench, ingenuitive and fluent in French, I mean. So we're not hampering anyone with Hamilton.
So you've been working on a sequel to Mary Poppins, not writing the music, but performing in it. And I'm actually not sure if this is a movie or a show.
It's a movie.
It's a
film. Rob Marshall is directing it.
And he did Chicago. He did the film of Chicago, which is great.
Chicago and Into the Woods. Yeah, he's
oh, right.
He's really
also great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's pretty incredible.
So are you still working on that right now?
Yeah, we've just finished up 6 weeks of rehearsal and we'll begin shooting next year.
Mm-hmm. Is it a relief for you to not have to leave Hamilton and immediately start writing another musical? Because like topping Hamilton is going to be so hard. I feel like you just like probably need a break from that. And I don't
You can't. If you think in terms of topping, you're in the wrong business.
Mm-hmm.
You can't think that way. I remember getting that question after In the Heights. It's your first musical and you won the Tony. Like, how are you going to top it? I'm like, I went from broke substitute teacher to Broadway composer. I will never make a leap that big in my life again. That's a huge leap. And I'm very lucky to have made that leap. In terms of performing, it's an enormous relief. It's an enormous relief to go to work and be an actor and not be worried about writing, just learning. I'm learning choreography and I'm, you know, learning my lines. And that's enormous fun. And I'm also learning from one of the best, you know, acting on screen in a very real way. I've done it a little bit, but I'm in pretty rarefied air in terms of the people around me. So I guess... getting back to legacy, you can't control the success or failure of a thing you work on. You can only control the thing you work on. And so I try to let my decisions be guided not by what I think will succeed or fail, but what I'm going to learn from that process. You know, I co-wrote a musical we didn't discuss called Bring It On the Musical, not because ever since I was a little boy I wanted to write about cheerleaders, but because I knew I'd be working with Andy Blankenbuehler and Tom Kitt and Jeff Witte and Amanda Green, and I knew I'd have three new tools for my songwriting toolkit from working with that caliber of artist. I could not have written Hamilton without having worked on Bring It On first. The joy is in finishing my run and then going and being a song and dance man for 6 months.
Right. Well, Lin-Manuel Miranda, it's just been wonderful to talk with you. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you so very much.
Likewise. The joy is mine.
Lin-Manuel Miranda created the musical Hamilton and originated the title role. He wrote several songs for the new Disney animated film Moana. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Omar Saif Gobash. His new book collects his thoughts on moderate Islam and is written in the form of letters to his two sons, urging them to find knowledge and understanding in all cultures and philosophies. Gobash is now the United Arab Emirates ambassador to Russia. His father was a UAE diplomat who was the unintended target of an assassin's bullet. I hope you'll join us. After the war, I went back to New York. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Mooj Zaidi. Teresa Madden directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
And the man is nonstop.
Gentlemen of the jury, I'm curious. Bear with me. Are you aware that we're making history? is the first murder trial of our brand new nation, the liberty behind the liberation. I intend to prove beyond the shadow of a doubt with my assistant counsel.
Co-counsel Hamilton, sit down. A client, Lemmy Weeks, is innocent. Call your first witness. That's all you had to say.
Okay.